across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. Thank you very, very much for all of the email that's been coming in. I've had more email than I've ever had in the last few weeks from people all over the world, and it means a lot to me, especially in these times of lockdown, that you want to get in touch with me and share your experiences of life and everything. You know, you can always do that, or if you want to make a guest suggestion or tell me anything, that's fine. But it's meant a lot to me to be able to get up in the morning, check the inbox and see that your email is there. It really is heartwarming on occasions just to hear your stories. And one thing that has become absolutely clear is that although we're separated by oceans and distance, that a lot of us are having the same sorts of feelings and experiences. We're going through the dreams or the nightmares sometimes, the lack of sleep and all of those things. Maybe we're replanning our lives, which I am. You know, I do not want to live in the way that I've lived for years when this is all over. And those are big words to say, and a lot of people are saying them, but I really want to make some changes. I have to live better, in a better place, and, you know, enjoy the things that used to bring me happiness, like nature and, you know, going to the seaside and stuff that I stopped doing. I mean, I'm being very honest with you here. I just kind of cut a lot of things out of my life. So this is my little story. I'm going to make a change. How about you? You can tell me all about anything you want. Make a guest suggestion, like I say, or anything. Go to my website, theunexplained.tv, designed and created by Adam from Creative Hotspot. Thank you, Adam. You can connect with me in any way that you want through the website. And it's been nice to hear from you in this extended period of lockdown. Okay, just a couple of shout-outs, and then we're going to get to the guest on this edition, who is a return to Michael Tellinger in South Africa. Adrian, thank you for your message through my Facebook page, The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. You asked me to give a shout-out to Blackall in central Queensland. I believe that's a family name, isn't it? But, yeah. I think that's what that is. So Blackall in central Queensland. Adrian and I say hi. Jordan in the south of France, good to hear from you. John in Portland, Oregon, thank you for your email. Trish at Lee near Manchester, good to hear from you, Trish. Robert, Arthur and Joe, good to hear from you. And Sharon, thank you very much for donating to The Unexplained. That was very kind of you, Sharon. And if you've donated recently, thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart. You can always do that through my website, theunexplained.tv. Michael Tellinger. I first spoke with him in an apartment in South Africa more than 10 years ago. We've been speaking every couple of years since then. Michael, well, this is his biography, okay? This is a bit of it. Michael is an author, scientist, explorer, and humanitarian who's become a real-life Indiana Jones, making groundbreaking discoveries about advanced vanished civilizations at the southern tip of Africa. That about says a thumbnail sketch, anyway, of what he is and what he does. He's also heavily involved in a movement called Ubuntu. Now, in this day and age where a lot of us realize that things are not going to be the same when we come out of lockdown and when the aftermath of coronavirus starts to abate, and that's going to take some time, a lot of us realize that maybe the way that we live our lives and that the way that society works is not going to be the same. Ubuntu has been speaking about those things for years. So we'll see if this is relevant now. With Michael Tellinger in South Africa coming very soon. Like I say, thank you for all of your messages. They mean so much to me. Please tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show when you get in touch. That's very, very kind. And if you've sent an email, and if I didn't just give you a shout out there, please know that I have seen it, and thank you very much indeed. Okay, guest on this edition then, a return to South Africa, 6,000 miles, 1 hour time difference away from here, and hello to Michael Tellinger. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Howard. So good to hear your voice again.
Nice to talk with you, Michael. And how are things in rural Mpumalanga then? Are you getting by?
Yes, Mpumalanga, South Africa is just hunky-dory. You know, South Africa is an interesting place, as you may deduce from the news. Don't always believe everything they show in the news because it's not always all true. But what happens in the small towns is that people are much less affected than in the cities. Yeah. You know, people are jovial and happy, and African nature is to be happy and smile and a lot of jokes all the time. That's just the African way of life. So this lockdown is really been quite a dramatic assault on the lifestyle and the way that Africans interact. And it's become an African culture. All of, not just black Africans, but all South Africans have this very friendly interaction. And so it's been quite an assault on our liberties and And I think people are getting really tired. There's some signs of we've had enough. We need to get back to work and resume life as we know it and as we want it.
Mm. I've never met a South African who didn't want to shake my hand, much more so than here. So that must be a real restriction because, as you say, South African people are tactile. They're very warm. And a situation that forces you to be distant from others is not going to play well. It's not playing well here, but it's not going to play well in South Africa, I wouldn't have thought. But at least you're coming out of lockdown, aren't you, at least?
Well, I'm not even sure. You know, quite frankly, I must say I've just been following this so scantily because we're out in the middle of nowhere. We live in a small town of 5,000 people. Plus, I'm on a reasonably large property on a river. So I just go into town once a week to get some milk and some supplies if I need and bread and come back. And we've been carrying on working on sharing information about the Ubuntu movement, the one small town. I'm making new videos for my video channel about the ancient civilizations and the fossils and everything I can do from my home. I go to Stone Circle Museum every now and then and I go and play around in the museum and go and walk around our property there. But everything is shut down. I'm in the tourism business. I have tourists that come from all over the world to come and look at the ancient ruins and the fossils. So that's been dead for 6 weeks now.
That's terrible. Well, I hope that all gets back to normal because South Africa as a whole, absolutely from Cape Town all the way up to the borders where you are, depends on tourism, depends on people going there. At the moment, there are no flights going there, I don't think, out of the United Kingdom. One of these days they may resume, but I hope things improve. But it's true, you're in a place where you're probably the most you get to experience it is what you see on the news, I would have thought.
Yeah, and the news, we know what the news is. We know who's behind the news. So there's always an agenda, always a propaganda angle built into it. So just be careful when you watch the news, especially the American channels. It's unbelievable what's happening with the disinformation and the fake news and the false news that they're putting out there. It is, I've never seen anything like this. I feel like I wake up every morning and I catch up with the mainstream news channels. There are a few, however, that are getting the real activities out there. But most of the mainstream news channels, I feel like we're in 100 years back in Bolshevik Russia, while the Tsar Nikolai is under attack by the Bolsheviks. That's what it feels like to me.
The one upside of all of this is that people are discovering the work of people like yourself. I mean, they're discovering my podcasts. I've had more reaction to those over these weeks than people using them through the lockdown and telling me that they're, discovering things through them. I'm sure you're getting that kind of response too for your ancient civilization research and also for the One Small Town movement.
Yes, very much so. Obviously, the ancient civilizations and the tourism side, visiting the sites, seeing the stone ruins, and then the fossils now recently, the last 2 years, which is a new big attraction. That's people are just really excited about this. They're finding me more and more, as you mentioned. But the big thing that is really grabbing people's attention, and I'd be completely lying if I didn't bring this up, and that's people waking up and realizing that we need to look at fixing the world, changing the way the world is run and what's happening in the world.
Well, certainly economic structures. It is a lot of people are saying, even people who are in politics themselves are maybe waking up to the fact that perhaps everything cannot be the same when we wake up from all of this. And that's something that we'll get into when we talk about Ubuntu.
Yeah, good.
Okay. Ancient civilizations. I suppose the way that we could talk about this is to just let my listener imagine the idea that you suddenly found Stonehenge in Africa. And what a wake-up call that would be. That's the place that you were at about 15 years or so ago, yeah?
Yeah, so that's an interesting and a nice intro, but I need to expand that a little bit. Imagine if I found Stonehenge in South Africa, but multiply that by 10 million. I found 10 million Stonehenges in South Africa. Okay, now let that sink in for a while.
I mean, that is a huge number.
Yes. And not just 10 million Stonehenge-type structures. Obviously, the stones aren't that big. We're talking about circular stone structures made up of much smaller stones. Nevertheless, there are 10 million or more of these structures that cover the whole of Southern Africa, South Africa and Zimbabwe mostly. including Great Zimbabwe, which is part of this ancient civilization, the structures they left behind, and many of the mysteries and anomalies and the tools and artifacts that I've had the great honor and privilege of discovering and sharing with the world for nearly 13 years now.
This is a silly question, maybe this is a daft question, and I don't think I've asked you this before. How were they discovered first?
Well, they were first discovered 500 years ago already when the Portuguese came around the Cape of Good Hope on the way to India. And they came on the African continent, and they around the Cape, and then the KwaZulu-Natal and Mozambique coastline. And then they started to discover these ancient stone circular structures, including Great Zimbabwe already then in the 1500s with Antonio Fernandez. And then it just disappeared. When they asked the locals in those days who built these structures, they were told by the locals, "We don't know. We didn't build them. We just occupy them." And that's 500 years ago. So it gets my blood pressure up when I hear recent academics start to tell us exactly who built these structures, when they were built, how they were built, and that they don't, none of them go further back than about 400 years, with a very, very long push, 500 years. So this is just a very clear indication of the ignorance and arrogance of our mainstream academia.
And maybe it's
and
also, maybe it's also a reflection of the fact that, you know, South Africa is well worth going to. And if you go there, unless your eyes are closed, then it'll open up your eyes and your heart. As far as I'm concerned, you will experience things that you will never have experienced up north. But the difficulty that you've always got there in South Africa is that you are down at the bottom end of a big continent, and it's a long way away from Los Angeles, and it's a long way away from London.
Well, it's a lot closer to Europe and London than from LA, but I guess I've been fortunate over the last 13 years that I've been out here in the country, right in the heart of all these stone structures. So imagine yourself, I'm literally in the middle of this never-ending network of ancient ruins that cover entire mountains, connected to each other by these channels, surrounded by never-ending agricultural terraces. This is spectacular. So since I've been here, since late 2007, I've must have brought about 7,000 people just on my own through the stone circles, the ruins, Adam's calendar, the giant footprint, and all the other just incredible ancient civilizations and the attractions from the vanished, what I call the vanished civilizations of Southern Africa.
Okay, now last time I was in Mpumalanga, which I love because it's so rural, and you know, it's for those who don't know, it's sort of north in South Africa, so it's not Cape Town at all. It's north. It's close to the border, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're close to Mozambique. The last time I was there, they were building roads and structures like they were going out of style. They were developing the place. If you say there's an ancient history there, is there a danger that a lot of that is going to get covered up by the march of so-called progress?
Oh, that's really been the greatest threat to and the most damage caused by roadworks, town development and town planning, new townships going up, farming, obviously, a huge role in destroying thousands and thousands of ancient ruins. It is unbelievable. And then mining, obviously, the big mines, especially the coal mines that cover vast areas. So, yes, all this development has caused great damage to the ancient ruins and civilizations.
So it's a but race, isn't it? It's a race to get the message out then.
Well, it is in a way. I think that we are getting there. There's definitely a rapid growth and expansion in people recognizing, identifying, and finding and discovering my work and this information. But the area is so vast. There are so many of these that we are fortunate for that reason. There are just so many of these, and many of the farms around me don't really have a danger of being developed or being farmed or mined at this stage. So we have a few very good examples that have been
I think your dog thinks there's something you missed out.
Yes, my dog is out here. I forgot to lock him up, so we might hear my dog barking every now and then.
It gives them a little bit of rural life coming through to our lockdown, I think, Michael. I don't think it's a problem at all, really. So, look, one of the other issues that South Africa had was the fact that South Africa's been through colonization. It's been through apartheid. It's been through a rebirth since 1994, 95. You know, it's been through so much that I guess research into these things that you're talking about has been a bit thin on the ground over the years?
Yes, it has been. It's gone through various agendas. And as you know, there are agendas by different political groups. That's what it is. Under apartheid, they used the apartheid regime and they used archaeology as an agenda to drive the philosophy of apartheid. And then now, unfortunately, under the new ANC government, we have a completely different agenda. Everything has to be of African tribal origin. If it's not of African tribal origin, then it's not going to appear in our history books. And that's a great shame. It's just spectacular how these agendas are being inserted into our lives.
And, you know, political agendas, whether it's apartheid or whether it's anything else, really have no place in this kind of research. It is surprising, it's sad, but it's not unusual around the world, is it, I guess?
It is criminal. It's criminal when politics and political agendas enter discoveries, ancient archaeology, studies of ancient civilizations. It is absolutely criminal, because what happens is that the lies then get written into our history books, and then we teach the lies at school and at universities, and our youth grows up believing a lie. So it is absolutely criminal, and we must do everything possible to uncover the lies of the past and of the present and share what we find, the raw material, the raw information and evidence that we find, so that people can reach their own conclusions.
Okay, I'm going to give you a chance to perhaps what breed is your dog?
Oh, it's a Ridgeback.
Okay, Ridgeback, a very common breed in South Africa. Not so common, I don't think here in this country, but I've seen a lot of them. Lovely dogs. So we'll give you a chance to move him. But the last point is, you're very sure that you're right about all of this. You're so sure that you're absolutely right about this.
I'm not just sure. I have the scientific evidence. I have the physical evidence. I have the geological evidence. I have the archaeological evidence. Everything is in my museum, plus all the ruins out covering the mountains. And what happens to people when they come here? Sometimes they come as skeptics, and then they leave with their minds completely blown. Or they come already expecting something, but even when they come expecting something because they've got prior knowledge, their minds still get blown. This is such a huge subject that nobody could have ever imagined that it was lying dormant under our feet for 500 years.
Michael Tellinger is here. We're talking about the ancient history of Africa, of South Africa, of the fact that there may have been 10 million Stonehenges or things like Stonehenges there. And what that means, the sorts of discoveries that have been made and the things that are exciting Michael Tellinger right now. So, Michael, we talked generally about this and why this is not more widely known and why you say when people get to find out about this, their, quotes, minds are blown. So let's go through some of the main things that you've come across then. What exactly have you found and what are the things that you believe are game changers?
Well, first of all, the large number of the stone circles is obviously the first mind-blowing realization. And then the next one is that the original structures have no doors and entrances. They are complete walls, circular structures with very interesting internal structures. And then the stone circles themselves are connected to each other by two sort of walls of stone that it looks like a little path. If you look at it from the air, people go to my website, michaeltellinger.com, have a look at the aerial photographs, and you realize they look like pathways that connect them. I call them channels that connect the stone circles to each other. And then all those stone circles collectively with the channels lie what I refer to as a spider's web effect. And the spider's web that just holds all these structures together in an ongoing sprawling structure that covers mountains. And these spider's web structures are often the terraces that go up and down quite sometimes very steep mountainsides or hillsides. These structures have no doors and entrances, and this is well documented in several archaeological surveys dating back to 1939 already by some of the main archaeological schools in South Africa, Bloemfontein University, for example. And they made it very clear that the original structures had no doors and entrances. So we have to immediately conclude that they were not built as dwellings for people or cows or any other kind of animals.
If you can't get into a place that you've built, that boggles the mind a little, because the first question it poses is, who would build something like that?
Well, somebody that wasn't building a dwelling or a house. And then you got to ask yourself, okay, well, if they weren't building dwellings and houses, first of all, who is it who built these structures? How far back does it go? And unfortunately for mainstream archaeology and mainstream universities, the dates that I work with are just so far out of their spectrum that they can't compute it. So we leave them behind very quickly. And it's really only those who have open minds that are prepared to embrace a whole new history that will go down this very exciting journey of discovery. And the evidence is right in front of us. We can't ignore it. We have to do what the guys at CSI do. And I often refer to this. I always say, I do what the guys at CSI do. I follow the clues and the evidence. And based on the clues and the evidence, I reach my conclusion. So today I may reach one conclusion, but tomorrow I find new clues and evidence, and therefore my conclusion from yesterday will shift and change to a new conclusion based on the current evidence that I have. Isn't that the best scientific explanation how we should work?
Well, I thought that was how science was supposed to work.
No, not at all. It works completely the opposite way, believe it or not. I'm not going to get into that, because then we get down a different rabbit hole. We'll never get out of that one.
All right.
So what happens is you need to have much more knowledge about various areas of the sciences, of religion, of mythology, of electronics, of geology, of many different areas of the various sciences. Otherwise, this will not make any sense to you. So one of the first things that happened to me when I started to research these stone structures is that I realized, first of all, that the mystery of the original structures have no doors and entrances. Yes, let me just qualify this. Yes, there are many that have been found in clusters that have been adapted and converted into dwelling places that have got doors and entrances, that the other external structures outside have been destroyed and adapted for whatever tribe occupied that cluster of stone circles. So yes, there are some that have been occupied in the last 250 years, maybe up to 300 years or 350 years by African tribes and use it for their purposes. And then we have a bunch of others that go back even 1000 BC when the Dravidians were here, but we can come back to that. What I discovered very soon after I started to research the stone circles was that the stones have a very strong acoustic property. We call them stones that ring like bells. And I actually have two of them right here. So I don't know if you can hear that.
That's a stone.
Yes, this is a stone.
Do you know something? I don't think I've heard a piece of marble sound like that, Michael.
These are some of the stones.
That's a bell-like ringing. Is there metal within that stone?
Oh, well, there's iron in the stone.
Okay, so that stone is ringing like an iron bar.
It's ringing like a bell. So I started calling these stones that ring like bells. And a lot of them have these elongated shapes that were very puzzling and confusing. Why would stones have this weird kind of shape? And that lasted for exactly 11 years before the penny dropped on January 2018. But we'll come back to that. So I realized that the stones in the stone structures have very strong acoustic properties. And then I started to look at the aerial photographs again. And because I'm a student of sound, I also have a degree in pharmaceutics from Wits Medical School, as you may or may not know. So I'm well qualified in making opinion about chemistry and organic chemistry and et cetera, molecular structures, biological structures, anatomy, and including healing, by the way.
So are you saying that it's believed that the sound of the stones has some kind of healing beneficial property?
Well, in a twisted way, it does, but I'm going to come back to that. All right. What I discovered is that the stone structures, when we first realized is that all the stones in the walls have acoustic properties because of the content of the rock. It's a very specific kind of rock. Most of the stone walls are either dolerite or they are Hornfels rock. Very few of the stone circles have different kinds of rock. Much more pure quartz in some of them, but I'm going into too much detail now for this interview. What I discovered is when you look at the aerial photographs and you know anything about cymatics or how sound manifests into physical form, are you aware and familiar with the term cymatics?
No.
Okay, cymatics is the study of sound and how sound manifests into physical form. And anyone listening to this, please go away, go to YouTube and watch the entire documentary of Hans Jenny. That's H-A-N-S, Hans, and Jenny, J-E-N-I, I think, or double N-I. And watch his documentary called Cymatics from the 60s. It will change your life and change the way you see the world around you when you start to realize how sound is a primordial source of everything. Keep in mind that the opening phrase of the Bible, it says, God said, let there be light. It was the sound of creation, the sound of the Creator. Whether you're a religious person or you're a spiritual person, it's the same thing. It's either primordial source code or God that spoke the universe into creation, the sound of creation. So once you realize, understand what sound is all about and how sound manifests into physical form, cymatics is the word that explains that science and the study of that. This is a huge area of research for decades and decades, and most people are completely oblivious of this. So when I looked at the aerial photographs of the stone circles, I immediately recognized that the patterns of the stone circles represent or resemble cymatic shapes and patterns. When you put sand on a metal plate and you put a sound frequency through the bottom of the metal plate and you move that sound frequency up like, right, very slowly.
Right. On the radio, we call that a frequency sweep. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Every frequency has a very distinct and unique shape that manifests, that forms in the sand. And that would be the cymatic shape or the cymatic pattern of that specific frequency. And that is locked. You can't change that. That's how sound and physical form interact. And then you get light into it. But I'm not going to go there now. But you have to have all this knowledge that I'm sharing with you to make any sense of the ancient civilizations, the ruins, and then the tools and artifacts that they left behind, which is a very advanced technology that used sound as a source for using energy and generating very powerful energies for doing all kinds of things with.
Right. So they understood they had a technology of their own. Do we know anything? And I'm sorry to cut across you because I want to make the most of every minute here. But do we know anything about the civilization, the race?
Well, the only civilization that was capable of doing this is what we get in the Sumerian texts. And whatever, you know, your listeners may think of this or not, this was not human. This was what the Sumerian texts refer to as the Anunna, or the Anunna gods, often referred to as the Anunnaki. So there's very clear reference in thousands and thousands of clay tablets. Okay, let me make it very clear. This is not one secret tablet that's held somewhere that's got this information on. This is a repetitive theme in thousands and thousands. In fact, let me be bold here and say millions of clay tablets, because at this stage, there have been millions of clay tablets that have been recovered. And pretty much the clay tablets is the history of the world that takes us back 6,000 years into the past, up to about 4,000, maybe 5,000 years BC. And there are many other clay tablets that have been hidden away and locked away. They don't want to release the information when they started to decode that. That's a whole another conspiracy theory. And that's connected to the British Museum research. Again, there's an agenda happening there, right? They found information in the ancient Sumerian texts that is so shocking that they don't want to release it to the world, and they keep it hidden. So all of that information in the Sumerian text talks about the Anunna gods, or the Anunnaki, under the leadership of Enki, which is the Sumerian primordial deity that basically created the Sumerian generation and empire. He was the deity, the god of the Sumerians, the supreme god, and he was responsible for starting the gold mining operations in what they refer to as the Abzu, or the Deep Abzu, which has been identified as Southern Africa, either Zimbabwe and South Africa, as the Abzu and the Deep Abzu, where the Anunnaki mined unimaginable amounts of gold. Can you see all the dots being connected there?
Well, I mean, gold is still the driving force of the South African economy.
Exactly. So we have ancient gold mining that goes back here 300,000 years and probably further back in time. Many of the structures that we've discovered, and this is brand new information that I've actually just discovered, brand new research from January 2020, from this year when I started to fly my drone and be able to navigate it myself over the stone ruins and spent time studying the structures instead of other people flying the drone for me and giving me pretty pictures. Now I was able to hover there and look at what I was specifically looking for and studying. And what I found out is that the rivers and ravines and streams that run down the mountains and cut through some of the stone ruins and the terraces and the channels that connect them together, those rivers are younger than the stone circle ruins and the terraces themselves.
Right. That's a big discovery.
That's a very big discovery. And that's just the most recent one. There are many other reasons why I can say these structures go back to at least 100,000 years and probably around 300,000 years. And I will be very bold and say probably even further back than that, because once you start reading the Sumerian texts as a historic event and not just somebody's crazy ideas, when you realize this is a real historic event, we go back, you know, 500,000 years probably.
Boy. That is mind-blowing. What about this ancient civilization? Were they, as some people say, is there evidence to suggest that they were highly intelligent? Yes, they must have been if they had a technology of their own, but were they giants?
Well, they definitely were. Even if you look at the drawings from the Sumerian drawings, the images of the Anunna or the Anunnaki or the Anunna gods, they were much larger than the humans. And they had obviously very special abilities. They had knowledge of genetic cloning. This is very clearly described in the Sumerian texts, how they cloned animals and cloned humans. This is very clearly described in the Sumerian texts. They had knowledge of sound, because I have discovered the evidence of the sound frequencies, the fact that they used magnetron technology, they used toroidal field technology, torus stones, like, you know, the donut-shaped stones that I have discovered, and we have these all in the museum. And then the cone-shaped tools, these are all contributions that I've made towards the field of archaeology and history that were completely ignored or unknown until I came here and started to pick up these artifacts and tools and bring them to the museum and start to study them, figure out what the hell is this all about? Why are these tools and things lying all over the mountains and always connected to the stone circle ruins? So they were highly advanced.
Well, if they were highly advanced, why are they not still here?
Well, who says they're not here? We just don't know where they are.
Right, so you think they may be almost hiding in plain sight today?
Absolutely. And you know, if they are here, they obviously in small numbers, there might be a few hundred of them. And if they've got advanced technology, they can fly around in their magnetic energy machines, gravity-free technology, because that's clearly what they had. And all the ancient civilizations refer to that all the time. Again, I don't think we got enough time to go into this, but I can take you through the technology.
So do you think that might explain what we call UFOs then, Michael?
A lot of them could be, yes. Some of them could be. The UFO phenomenon is a fascinating one, and it's becoming more and more interesting as the rabbit hole deepens. It seems that a lot of the UFOs that we're discovering is advanced technology developed by the secret military industrial complex and not necessarily extraterrestrial, but there are many that are of some sort of extraterrestrial origin as well. Obviously, not all of it is of human origin.
What are you going to do with this knowledge then? What do you think? All right, let's put it this way. Let's turn it round from there. What do you want us to know about what you've discovered?
The key thing here is to realize that we know virtually nothing about our human history. And I really would like to stress this as strongly as possible. Take your history books and burn them. Right, really, and start researching again. What is very clear to me right now is that most of our history books is just an account of the agenda of the ruling party at the time that wrote down the history. They wanted people of the time to see it and read it and future generations to know so they could either promote, continue their agenda and their propaganda into their descendants, so they could rule the peasants and so forth, and it's just the whole of history is just one big mess. And the more you start looking into ancient human history, the more obvious it becomes. And what I've discovered here is so far removed from anything we've been shown or taught in any history book anywhere that it makes me go, how come this has been here for so long? How come I come along, 13, 14 years ago? And I make this discovery, and it's so obvious that it boggles the mind. So our history of this planet is much more different from what anybody could have imagined. Go and do more research. Find the alternative documentaries of people that are not necessarily attached to the mainstream. Unfortunately, I have to go against the grain here. I've always been against the grain, as you know, and because you don't get much wisdom out of that. I spent 5 years at Wits Medical School. I spend the rest of my life unlearning what I learned there, Howard, just to make it very clear to anybody that still thinks that you get some sort of education at the university.
Well, I hear what you say about that. That's not going to be good news to a lot of students right now, but I hear what you say. But we've got a lot of catching up to do. Just quickly before we come to the end of this section, do you think that what you have discovered in South Africa ties into what is being discovered and found in places like Göbekli Tepe up here in Europe, things that people like Graham Hancock have been saying and Robert Schock doing his research, neither of whom have been in the mainstream, of course, like yourself. Does it all tie together?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What I can tell you with a very high degree of belief is and certainty is that all these ancient structures we find, especially the stone circles, in fact the stone circles of Southern Africa, were the trigger point. They were the ancient structures that showed us the technology that the ancient civilizations or the Anunnaki were capable of. There's no question about it. And that's all to do with sound and knowing how to use sound as a tool and basically doing everything with it. I'm talking everything, like using sound as phaser beams. Now, if your listeners have never heard of phaser beams, I can't explain it now. Go and do some research. It is the most advanced technology on Earth available today, far more powerful and important than laser beams. Okay, laser beams are one area, and then you get to phaser beams, which is a whole different kettle of fish. And this is why the phaser beam technology has not been released to the public, because it's too dangerous. You can literally use it as a weapon to blow up airplanes out of the sky, submarines out of the water, blow up ships. You can use a phaser beam as a deadly attack tool or a deadly defense.
And you're saying that these ancients in Africa had and used for good, presumably, that technology.
Absolutely. What is very clear, and we have dozens and dozens of measurements that we've done over the past decade and more, are the frequencies, the sound frequencies, and other electronic measurements that we've measured coming from the stone circles that are generated by the stone circles. So let me just backtrack a little bit, because when I first recognized that the stone circles resembled cymatic patterns, more or less at the same time, and cymatic patterns mean a specific shape that the sound manifests when the sound frequency coming out of the ground hits the surface of the earth, right? Mm-hmm. So then I recognize that, because anyone that has done any research will know that the earth rings like a bell all the time. The earth never stops ringing, right? And there are various frequencies that are out there. One of the famous ones is the Schumann resonance and many others. But this ringing bell effect of the earth is what these ancients utilized to generate energy. So every stone circle is a manifestation. It shows you the shape of the sound coming out of the earth at that specific place. And guess what? Even in their state of disrepair and broken downedness, the stone circles are still alive. They're still giving us high frequencies in the gigahertz. They're giving us electromagnetic fields in like 480 megahertz and higher. It's at Adam's calendar going up to 1800 and 2000
megahertz. Okay, I'm going to pick that up with you briefly, then we'll talk about Ubuntu in the next segment here. Michael Tellinger, direct from Mpumalanga, South Africa. More from him in just a second. And Michael, I know you want to talk about Ubuntu, and so do I, but just to cap this off then, this discovery of the way that this ancient civilization you think used sound, you think this is something that we might be able to pick up on if mainstream science would look into the work that you're doing, yeah?
Well, look, they don't have to look into the work I'm doing. I'm sure they're pretty aware of it because they use the technology already, but they just, the average person in the street is not aware of it. This is crazy. This is like, we are surrounded by advanced technology, but we don't understand the technology. You see, and now these ancient civilizations have made it very clear that they were 300,000 years ahead of the program. We've just discovered it recently. The toroidal fields, obviously, this is the fundamental thing of the toroidal field technologies and the torus donut-shaped stones that are very powerful vortex field energy generators. And anyone that studies science and quantum fields will know this. They understand that the number one attraction and study field in the world right now is vortex fields. The zero point of vortex fields. Everyone is going crazy about finding zero point energy. Exactly. And that's what you get in toroidal fields, which are often referred to as vortex fields or torsion fields. And unfortunately, our entire quantum field and quantum mechanics and the quantum particle field of science has been hijacked and has been pushed down the wrong track, the wrong channel. But I will refer people to my website and my YouTube channels if they want to pick up more on that research and that study, because it's a spectacular deception what is going on in the education field.
Now, unfortunately, you know, the world is, well, not exactly completely stalled, but a lot of things have been stalled because of coronavirus. It's going to take us a while to climb away from all of this and for ingenuity to be able to solve it and all the rest of it. But when we come out of it, what would you like to happen with this research? What would you like people to do about it?
Well, the research of the ancient civilizations, believe it or not, is what led me to the discovery in ancient times of money, when money suddenly made its appearance on Earth. And I realized that everything I was ever told about money is a lie. So that really took me on a journey of personal growth, spiritual growth, consciousness growth, expansion, and just trying to make sense of this crazy, insane world that we find ourselves in, where much of what we are told is probably not true, and that we kept in some sort of a spell most of our lives, and started to realize that the whole money system that we grow up into and believe is normal is not necessarily the only system that we can have.
Right.
And I started to,
that takes us to this Ubuntu idea. That we can organize society. And you only start to look at these things, I think a lot of people will only start reading about these things because of the situation we're in now. But you've been doing this work for a while. But there is, you say, there's the economy that we have now, which is going to be in trouble for a good long while after coronavirus, we believe. But there's another way.
There is another way, and this is what I started to explore in 2005. So it's been a long 15-year journey. So it's not something that I came up with or started to promote last week or last month or last year. So it's been a long, hard, blood, sweat, and tears journey of discovery to realize that our global social structure, our socioeconomic system is basically, it's such a mess that it cannot be fixed. First of all, I always ask people when I do my lectures, how many of us are happy with the way the world is going? Can I give you some really shocking news, Howard? In what is it now, nearly 15 years that I've been traveling the world doing lectures in more than 30 countries around the world, sometimes to audiences as large as 3,000, no one has ever put up their hand. No one has ever put up
Now,
their hand.
is that because people really are not happy about the way things are, or just because it's the human condition that people are tend
No.
a lot of people tend to be glass half empty?
Well, the question is, are you happy with the way the world is going? Are you happy with what the governments are doing? Are you happy what's happening in your life? How you're struggling and struggling to survive? Are you happy how things are getting tougher and tougher every year? And the answer to that is a very definite no. Nobody is happy. Very, very few people. It's only the bourgeois rich that can probably say, but even they're not happy. They're constantly worried about how they're going to be taken out by the next guy that tries to compete with them. So they live life filled with stress because they're worried about not losing what they've accumulated.
Right,
So
but we've tried other ways of organizing society before. If you look at the USSR, that was supposed to be a communist utopia, and that collapsed.
yeah, but do not, Howard, I've got to stop you there. You can't, you cannot try and explain to people that communism and capitalism are two separate things. It's run by the same group of global elite bankers. All of those, the communism was constructed by the Rothschild banking family that infiltrated the USSR through the Bolshevik Revolution that they funded to create a one extreme of a capitalist society,
Okay, all
an
right.
absolute dictatorship of capitalism. And then on the other side, they created the United States, where capitalism takes this freedom on, and they created these opposing parties. So, yes, we've tried. What people are under the incorrect perception or an illusion that we've tried other structures. We have not. In the past 270 years, since the launch of the Rothschild banking empire in the 1760s, we have been under lockdown and absolute control by a global financial empire that has not let us out of their grip. So we need to do something new. And what I've discovered, and if your listeners are new to this, then please go away and do some research or read the Ubuntu book. Read my Ubuntu book. It'll give you all the information in one solid book with you. It'll blow your mind because it'll be new to you, but it'll wake you up, right? So what this teaches us, that every system we've had as a human race has failed us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in this mess. So we have a choice. Either we can carry on using the same system and going on, hoping that we're going to fix it or improve it, or we can create a new system that actually works for the human race, works for humanity, where our leaders that we appoint to be our servants actually act as our servants and stop acting as our slave masters, which is obviously the case, what's going on right now. And
Okay.
this is what has evolved. It
Oh.
is this very beautiful, slow, organic growth and evolution of the Ubuntu philosophy that morphed into what in 2016 then became One Small Town Can Change the World. And I must tell you, it took 13 years of blood, sweat, and tears to get to that realization that we cannot fight the system. You cannot oppose the system. You cannot resist the system because the system has been structured and created by the global banking or the royal political elite that control all the creation and the supply of money on earth.
I hear what you're saying, but every time you come on and say that, obviously I will get email from people who severely disagree with that. And you cannot disagree with the fact that an awful lot of people have been taken out of poverty by the system that we have. If I think about the way that my
Yes.
great-grandparents and their grandparents would have lived, they were poor. And my father lived a better life than they did. Now, all right, I don't live financially. I think my father was in a better position than I am, but that's just because I chose to be on the radio. But, you know, we've improved ourselves, and the system that we've had has allowed that. I mean, I really don't want to get into a big debate about this because only because we don't have the time, but you know, the system that we have has served billions of people on this planet well.
Well, it hasn't. It has enslaved billions of people. It served a very small number of people well. The rest of the people work like slaves, and life's getting harder and tougher every year, and people are not happy. Clearly, people are not happy, especially now when we've been locked down and all our human rights have been violated on every possible level. But we're not going to get into that.
No, okay. So
What I want,
we've got
I need to give you.
five golden minutes here, then. Explain to me how Ubuntu works.
I need to give you the good news here. First of all, anybody listening to this, please do me a favor, go online, find the Ubuntu book, Ubuntu Contributionism, Blueprint for Human Prosperity. You can find it on my website, find it, you can download it from Amazon. It will give you the foundation of what I'm talking about. You first have to step out of the box, thinking that we have to live in a world where money is used, where money is used to solve all the problems. Money is money was injected into humanity some 6,000 years ago, and you read about this in the Sumerian tablets, and this is what I teach people at my lectures, in my book. It's all there. Once you realize that money is not part of human evolution or the human psyche or the human spirit, it is an injected tool of enslavement some 6,000 years ago by the first priest kings that mysteriously suddenly appear on earth out of the blue. These first priest kings appear, and we read about them in the Sumerian tablets. These first priest kings had powerful, mysterious weapons with which they could smite and control their people, and this is why people listened to them. Otherwise, why would they be king? Okay, Nobody would say, well, you can now own all the land, you can be the king, you can take all our land. No, the only reason they became king is they had fierce weapons of mass destruction with which they could smite the people. And these first kings lived in their big temples, and they started to issue the first forms of money in the form of clay tablets. This is how far back the banking system goes. And the staggering thing is that the way that they issued those ancient clay tablets were in the forms of negotiable instruments in clay. The same way we do it today on paper, they were doing it in clay. Bills, checks, promissory notes written in clay. It is quite spectacular. So you realize once this penny drops for people, you realize this is a very malicious introduction of an absolute tool of enslavement.
Okay, now I went to the supermarket just before we recorded this. I was wearing my mask and I had my hand sanitizer with me because that's how things are now. But, you know, I spent £40 on groceries. The money that I got for that, you know, I earned by doing radio shows and, you know, that sort of stuff. That's what I do for a living. Remunerating me for the work that I do. And then I went and spent it in the local supermarket to buy some food for myself. What's wrong with that?
Now, I'm not used to doing shows like this where I have to argue and haggle with people, because generally I do a lot of shows where people are already aware of this and they've realized that we need to get rid of money. So let me answer you very quickly. You keep going back to this money thing as if it's the life force of everything. Put it away. Let me explain to you where we're going from here, right? Because if you don't allow me to explain to you, then we're not going to get there.
Okay. Tell me.
So you have to realize what I was saying, that you can't fight the system because the system was constructed. Sometimes it's called the Babylonian black magic money system. You may have heard that expression, and that's pretty much what it is. And it's quite scary what it does, because the entire financial system, as we know it today, has been structured so that it destroys anything and everyone that stands to confront it or to try and topple it. And it is spectacular. And so what we have to do is what Buckminster Fuller became quite famous for, famous American, brilliant mind, human being. And he said that you can't fight the system. What you have to do is you have to create a new system that makes the existing system obsolete. And that is what I discovered through, like I said, 15 years of blood, sweat, and tears. First going into politics, opposing the system, opposing blah, blah. The moment you enter politics, you're entering a system of opposition, opposing the other political parties. That is not a solution.
Did you get elected?
Unfortunately, we don't have enough time to go into that. I will talk volumes about it because I ran in politics for three different elections in South Africa and in Canada and in the UK, almost in Canada, in the UK and in Australia. So believe me, I have enough experience in politics to be able to explain to you why it does not work. But what does work is the Ubuntu contributionism philosophy that has evolved into a system where you can do what you want. You said you could remunerate it for your radio show.
Yeah.
Well, imagine if you could live in a society, which is possible for people that will go and study the one small town. It's not a study. It's a probably spend 2 hours before or maybe some people 10 minutes and the penny will drop for you. And imagine if you lived in a society of your own choice where you could do what you're doing here and know that you're loved and respected for what you're doing, because the whole community benefits from what it is that you do. So you're contributing to the well-being of your community. And there are so many people with so many different talents and skills that would love to go and apply their skills and talents, for which they would be rewarded first of all, with the respect of the other people, which is what most of us want. We want to be loved and respected and honored for who we are and what we do. And then secondly, have some sort of remuneration. Now, in the one small town strategy that has evolved out of the Ubuntu movement over 15 years, it is a solution for small towns that happens without any violence, opposition, or conflict. We use the tools of enslavement as tools of liberation, and we turn the small town into the most unbelievable example of capitalist and economic success. And yet, at the same time, are we doing this? And the town becomes incredibly rich from all the businesses and projects and innovation that we start as a community that cooperates and collaborates instead of competing. We create so much success that it creates a knock-on effect to all the other towns around you, and then eventually across borders and across the whole world very, very quickly. But what happens in this process, and people, please go watch the One Small Town video. It's a short 5-minute video, inspirational video that'll make you see this and get very excited about this. What happens in the One Small Town is, while we're creating this wealth for ourselves from producing and manufacturing and inventing and selling and exporting, in our town, everything that we do, people that contribute towards the businesses and the projects don't have to pay for anything. So everything is free in our town to those people that participate. The models are well developed. It has been well studied, well argued. It is a fully evolved structure and a system. It provides a solution for pretty much every imaginable problem we face as the human race.
And really sadly, we've only got a minute left because it's a radio show, and I'm sorry about that, because we've tried to cover two different things that are both fascinating in this. And we will talk about this again, Michael. Last point that I'll make to you, though, is, you know, I like the sound of what you're talking about, but doesn't that just lead to mediocrity? Doesn't it mean that, you know, there will be people who won't pull their weight in this system?
Yes, it's a solution. What I recommend to people, go watch the videos, you realize that that's not possible. There is no space for mediocrity. Then you're just going to die, because you're not going to participate from all the benefits that the community is creating.
Okay, Michael, I'm sorry that I had to cut you off at this point. What's your website?
MichaelTellinger.com and UbuntuPlanet.org.
Michael Tellinger in South Africa, a guest on this show a number of times. And what did you think about what he had to say? If you want to get in touch with me and tell me, then please go to the website, theunexplained.tv, and you can certainly do that. I'm completely out of time. More great guests in the pipeline here on The Unexplained Online. So until next we meet, please stay safe. Please stay at home for now. Please stay calm, and please stay in touch. Thank you very much for staying in touch with me. I'll see you very soon on the next edition of The Unexplained. Please take care. Bye-bye.